Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The big question about biogenetic medicine came in the same package as the breakthrough technology. Here it is. What if the amazing tricks of hacking, tweaking, repairing, editing, improving the source code of human life got out of control somehow, got overwhelmed by off-target mutations, side effects, or money motives, or just cosmetic vanity? From China this week comes news that the so-called CRISPR method of custom tailoring DNA, this century's biggest biotech innovation, is out of control already. Dr. He Zhangkui, the Chinese pronunciation, sounds as much like salesman as scientist in his very slick video, explaining that he had knocked a multi-purpose gene out of the germline of twins in embryo so as to lessen the chance of their being infected someday by the AIDS virus, HIV. Nobody has seen the evidence yet, but shock and outrage was the respectable response everywhere. Chinese doctors called Dr. He's project crazy, and the Chinese government has shut him down. But maybe the real news was that not quite anybody, but all manner of DIY dreamers out there can do their garage band gene science, without anybody's permission, and who knows what effects. On Boston Common this week, we sampled citizen takes on gene editing.
If it's true, I think it's alarming. I'm yet to be convinced that it's absolutely true. I think there's a lot of incentive to say that it's true. Who wouldn't want to be the first on a breakthrough like that?
We try to say it's wrong to change humanity. That's probably okay to say. And if we say, let's try to fix humanity or something like that, I think there's problems about that. And I think our belief in God plays into it. I think our belief in what it means to be human plays into that.
I know in my husband's family, cystic fibrosis runs in the family, so if they were able to get rid of a gene that it wouldn't put them at risk for diseases like that, I could see the benefits of that. I just worry about where that road could lead.
It's a very cool concept, but morally, it's a little iffy.
I think fooling around with the human genome, we don't know enough yet. I mean, there might be a reason to do it. Designer babies, I don't think we're ready for yet, if ever.
A few things. I mean, I get from my parents, hereditary-wise, I get kidney stones from my mother, which are terrible, and I can't stand. If somebody could get those out of there, that'd be great. And 8 out of 10 family members have cancer, which would be a nice thing if they could eventually figure out how to get that out of. And Alzheimer's, dementia I have in my family also, which would be amazing. And yeah.
Well, I guess I am against it, and we still don't know what the long-term outcomes will be.
Pretty amazing that we can do that, but it's so not natural at all.
So, it is wake-up time in the age of biogenetics, and the stakes are clearer. The issues are more urgent, as some of the scientists knew all along. In the forefront of the race for a CRISPR Nobel Prize, the Berkeley biologist Jennifer Doudna trembles at the new power scientists have awarded themselves. She says, we are into a soul-shaking revolution in gene editing. About her own work, she says, we have control now. We have the ability to direct the evolution of our species, shaped until now by random mutation and natural selection. But who are the we that do the editing, or have the editing done to them, or not done to them? Who are the we who decide what can and cannot be tweaked for reasons of health or some other enhancement? Bioethicist Jeantine Lunshoff, trained in philosophy in Amsterdam, gets us started. She is the ethical collaborator inside Dr. George Church's synthetic biology lab at Harvard Med School. Begin, if you will, Dr. Lunshoff, with the question that you would put to Dr. Hu in Shenzhen before he impregnated a woman with 2 gene-edited embryos. What are you doing, doctor, you would have said.
Yeah, why are you doing this?
Fame and fortune, young lady, he would have said, or might have. No, he would have said, we're relieving the pressure on parents worried by HIV diagnoses about having children, doing them the world a huge favor?
That would not be a sufficient answer, because that's not completely true. And in his own application to the ethics committee of his hospital, he is very clear about what his purposes were. And among it is strengthening the competitive position of China in the world of science and reproductive medicine. And he refers to Nobel Prizes.
You think it was a national impetus, or it's now taken as a great shame to the Chinese industry?
Yeah, unfortunately for him, that came not to his mind.
Mm.
But the weird thing is that the ethics committee approved of this application.
What did the Chinese doctor do that hasn't been done secretly in this country already?
I have no reason to think that the procedure that he carried out, making changes in embryos and implanting them and establishing a pregnancy, has been carried out by anyone in the United States or Europe.
We're not absolutely certain that he did it, but he also made it look easy, almost. I'm wondering, on the forward calendar in George Church's laboratory, when does the first edited baby arrive?
Not from the Church lab. As the Church lab is not working with human embryos or even with human germs, gametes, sperm, or egg cells.
I want to know how you and George Church's lab think about these things. An eminent retired biologist said to me the other day, it's just a matter of time till the Church lab synthesizes a human cell, someday a human being. Will it be one of us or something different out of the, you know, the Body Snatchers movie? And if somebody shoots that creature, will it be murder?
That is too much for a philosopher to wrap her head around. Even if there would be a synthetic cell from which we are still far away, that is by no means a synthetic organism, let alone a human organism. And about the shooting, that may be a typical American twist to the story.
No. Where are we in the rights and wrongs on this subject? And I wonder, a little skeptically, about the outrage among the famous, some of them Nobel Prize scientists in this country, who are shocked. They're just shocked that people are thinking of this stuff. And they're thinking about it all the time.
That they're thinking about human germline editing? That's your question?
Yeah, yeah. Germline meaning heritable changes. The children of the children of the children will inherit these improvements.
That's what you would hope. It is no way certain that indeed would go over so many generations. That evidence will take long to bring, of course, longer than any one of us lives. The opinions on whether we should make changes that are heritable, the opinions on it are very divided. Some people have fundamental objections to it. I belong also to the ethicist in my profession, to the people who are not in principle opposed to interventions in the human germline.
Explain that. You are relatively permissive on this scale of intervention in the germline.
Yes, it is always a balancing, and it's the classical balancing in ethics of harms over benefits. And there can be so good reasons, the benefits, the expected benefits, can be so big that a decision would be justifiable to do such an intervention.
Won't it take a lifetime in these Chinese girls to establish whether it was a wise intervention or not? A lifetime of side effects and unexpected, unexpected results.
Theoretically, it could take a lifetime. It would, at least till these girls would have children themselves, you would see whether it's indeed inherited further down the line. We must, of course, all hope that the side effects of this intervention do not appear much earlier. because one of the side effects of the CCR5 deletion is an increased susceptibility for a fatal course of influenza, for the flu. So God forbid that one of these children, or the child in which the edit was successful, would attract flu within the next 6 months or so, because then the risk that she would die would be much larger than in any other child.
Just imagine that an edited child develops cancer at age 60. Will there be any tracing of the source of that problem?
That is a difficult question. That would be something for a tumor biologist to answer. It will also depend on the type of cancer, of course. And I do not know in how far such cells could be tracked down.
For me, as I said, the lead in the story really is George Church's remark that the genie is out of the bottle and it doesn't go back. Meaning, I take it that in China, in this country, amateurs, clever amateurs, well-schooled in the science, can imagine doing this sort of thing in a lab, even at home.
Well, I think given the whole procedure that is necessary to produce in vitro babies, establish pregnancies, that is not something that anyone can do in a garage. There is a large medical team involved, and that is even still separate from the work in the lab on cells and the actual editing. So this is not something for do-it-yourself biologists.
There is some history here, and not all the early experiments in the great labs have worked. I mean, there have been targets missed and side effects. What are the ones that burden you most in the middle of the night? The mistakes that, you know, didn't have to be undertaken?
In gene editing in general, or
yes,
in
the CRISPR realm.
In the CRISPR realm, it's in part well, of course, the uncertainty about outcomes. But you must be aware that 99% of what the work that's done in CRISPR with CRISPR using CRISPR is done at the bench in small organisms, just for a better understanding of genetics.
So many more questions, and we'll get to them. Coming up, another eminence in bioethics in our midst, Sheila Jasanoff. She says it's the human future that we ought to be talking about more, maybe even than the science. This is Open Source. On the old principle that war is too important to be left to the generals, another question is, where were the civilians at the CRISPR scientists' big meeting in Hong Kong this week? Welcome, Sheila Jasanoff, pioneer in testing the human and social implications of the advanced biosciences. Born in India, trained first as a lawyer, Sheila Jasanoff writes and teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School around the overlap of technology and politics in democracies around the world. You write about the Chinese doctor that he did the experiment that wasn't supposed to happen, but you say it could have happened here. How so? How would it happen? Has it happened?
Well, if it has happened, we certainly don't know about it. I think it'd be much harder for it to happen here because I don't know what the Chinese ethics committees were up to, but I have a strong idea of the kinds of ethics committees that we have to go through. We're converging on these kinds of things, but we still draw a pretty sharp line between embryos that are just there as research materials and embryos that are going to be implanted into human bodies for the sake of producing a baby. So that line between work for the sake of finding things out and work for the sake of producing a baby, that has not yet been crossed. My concern is that in a way the Dr. He experiment may have been fulfilling a kind of different promise, because really, as long as gene editing has been around, there's been a subliminal discourse among the biologists that if it happens anywhere, it's going to happen in China. And when you put that together with the idea that everybody is in a race to make these clinical applications happen as soon as possible, you have to wonder whether almost the stage was set for this to happen in China as a kind of green light then for other people to
do. I want to get to the mindset here. You wrote in the Washington Post op-ed this morning that official science in the United States and Dr. He were in a sort of genetic fix for social and emotional and personal and human problems. We got to get our heads out or stand back from the genes. Just what do you mean?
Well, by the genetic fix, I think what I and my co-authors mean is that you look at a problem, and then because you have this tool around, you know, when you have a hammer, the world looks like nails. And ever since the birth of the genetic engineering revolution, social problems have tended to be reduced to genetic ones. And then it becomes a sort of plaything. Because we can do it, we should do it. There was a time not that long ago in our own history when we tried to say violence in cities could be cured by genetic fixes. And this is heading in that sort of a direction, I fear.
That's fascinating. It reminds me of there's a Marxist tradition. Dr. Richard Levins at the Harvard School of Public Health embodied it, that this is kind of nonsense. It's a flight from social treatment of social problems to run into the genes. But maybe we'll get back to that. What I've seen of your next book is completely fascinating, explaining the modern supremacy of biology, including what you call the privatization of progress, not merely but the rise of biology as the ultimate source of wisdom on where we came from, who we are, where we're going. It's also a story of science uniting with capital, big capital, to redefine our imagination of progress. And as I read it, I thought, this is the story of Boston in the last 20, 25 years. They discovered a sort of capitalist wet dream of endless experimentation, high-level profits, government support, private riches, everything is here. How did it happen?
Well, it happened because there are places like Harvard and MIT that are producing sources of knowledge, and knowledge is the new capital in modern industrial societies. We're looking to something that people call the Fourth Industrial Revolution, in which we no longer extract things out of the soil and out of the earth, but rather out of our heads, and thereby manipulate things that grow elsewhere. So how it happened is a very interesting story, and one can tell it by just looking at Kendall Square and the buildings that have grown up around there, around MIT. You said a moment ago that it was science that was doing this, but I think that the if you're going to refer to Dr. Levins, that what he saw back already 20, 30 years ago about the alliance between science and capital is something that has pushed ahead much more rapidly than...
We call them the Erics. Eric Lander in science and Eric Schmidt at Google, right?
Well, and perhaps I won't go quite there, but it is a new...
Well, they meet and they talk and they invest in each other's dreams.
Well, we've decided that governments ought to take a back seat. This is an across-the-board abdication of responsibility in a way. It used to be that we thought that if public goals were going to be set, we should do it through legislatures and we should do it through public deliberation. There was a thing called the Office of Technology Assessment, whose job it was to advise the U.S. Congress on what sort of policies ought to be followed. But it was part of the Gingrich Revolution to shut down that OTA. And with that has come, I mean, without glorifying any particular agency, with that has come a gradual weakening of any kind of public deliberation on public ends. And instead, the idea is that incentivizing ought to go on at the individual level, private level, and private money has begun to dictate what the public purposes of new technologies are.
There was a great scientific meeting in Washington 3 years ago, almost exactly. And one of the promises there was a robust public debate around these issues. They're not all philosophical. It's sort of who gets what, but also is this the way we ought to be approaching, say, crime in cities or whatever. And it's never happened. I wonder, maybe this is for Jeantine, in Hong Kong this week, where is the public voice? And to me, that becomes a sort of ethical question. Can this be done in the councils of overtrained, over-rewarded brilliant scientists, or do we have to have plain people in this conversation?
We absolutely do need to have plain people in this conversation. However, the power of really doing these things is indeed in the hands of the brilliant minds and the brilliant lab people. And I think it's incredibly important that they take their responsibility and discuss among each other and set the limits among each other for what they are going to find acceptable or not. That is the place, in my opinion, that is really the place where the control needs to start.
Where might we see it? Where would it be held? What would the feedback loop be in public thinking as we dipped into it on the Common this week?
I think the public reaction at this moment is there, and the professions will need to give answers.
What do you hear the people saying, even on the Common?
Well, I think that is very much like the introductory part of what we heard at the beginning, that I think the opinions are very different. And what you hear in the comments, I've also been an advisor to patient and parents organizations, people affected by hereditary diseases. And it's often very much colored by the personal experience and experience in the family. And people who have genetic diseases in the family, they, regardless of their political or religious value systems, they tend to be very interested and have great hopes, of course, of the newer technologies.
Sheila Jasnov, where would this debate take place?
One of the things we've said is that those forums don't exist. And I have to disagree with Dr. Lunsov on this idea that it has to begin with the brilliant minds in science. First of all, I don't think brilliance lodges only in scientific minds. And we're talking about moral brilliance and ethical brilliance and legal brilliance and policy brilliance and democratic brilliance. And for those things, you don't construct a summit only of biologists talking to other biologists. That, to me, is a non-starter. That is not the forum.
How would we get one?
We would get one by creating something.
How do we insist on one, I guess, is what I mean.
Go ahead. One can, of course, take to the streets, but people like me take to the pen, and we write things, and we hope to persuade people. And there are models. I mean, this is something that really needs to be talked about openly. It's not just that there's a preference for not editing the human genome. There are legal prescriptions in various parts of the world that countries have signed onto, and it is positively illegal in many parts of the world. So just because American scientists might get together and say, look, we should now be doing translational medicine geared toward getting these discoveries out into the world of application and practice, it doesn't mean that everybody is on board with that at all. So I think interlinked transnational fora like the Genome Observatory that my colleagues and I have proposed would be a start.
Let's hear about it. The Genome Observatory.
Yeah, so what we think is needed is a supervisory body that is not making regulations, but is acting as a clearinghouse for information, is hosting workshops where people with radically different views can come together. In the course of our research, we found that people are extremely ignorant about what their neighbors are doing. So Canadians don't necessarily know what Americans are doing, and none of them know what the Germans are doing, let alone what China and India might be doing. So I think that those conversations need to be genuinely global, not like this summit, which is essentially a bilateral or trilateral initiative. You know, if we want to do climate change, which concerns humanity, we think that something like 190 countries must be involved. So if we want to tinker with humanity's future, we should reduce it to just scientists from three countries talking to one another.
As you speak, I'm just thinking, with a modification in the human structure, that obviously is not going to go to everybody. It's going to cost something. It's going to be there's going to be a decision on who gets it and who doesn't. Isn't that almost a prescription for injustice, an invented injustice? And then later, who knows, a two-tier humanity?
Well, it would probably be a multi-tier humanity, but there's no question that the kinds of benefits that people are looking to, for instance, through research on immortality, I mean, that's where your Erics of the world are putting their money. To some extent, this has been widely reported that the Silicon Valley titans are interested in immortality. I think you have to be a billionaire at the moment to conceive of things like that. So, yes, indeed, it may be that lots of people will die at normal lifespans and very few will live forever. That's an interesting model of rule that Plato's democracy theory did not contemplate.
Would you and Jeantine want to argue permissive standard as to what experiments you'd allow?
Well, I don't think it's all a matter of cost-benefit analysis. It's possible that professional ethics thinks that, but I think only of a particular school of ethics. I think there are decisions about what we should be doing that should not be put to a cost-benefit analysis test.
Like?
Well, like this Chinese experiment in which a particular kind of social ill, that is the fear of stigma from AIDS in Chinese society, has suddenly been translated into a mandate that little babies should be born without the possibility of contracting this particular disease. I have to note that a lot of these kinds of experiments with sexuality have been conducted on female bodies before male bodies, and even that is a kind of issue that seems not to have been discussed.
Does this raise your hackles, Jeantine?
I agree with the last part that Dr. Yazanov said, but I want to point out I did not speak about cost-benefit balancing. I spoke about harms and benefits balancing as they are made by families affected by genetic diseases. And then this balancing is also done or should done by and that is in general in medical interventions and trials. For any trial, there should be a balancing of harms and benefits. And that is one of the striking things in the He case, that there are actually no benefits anywhere. And the risk of harm, apart from, say, the injustice and the determined future of these children, but the risk of harm is too large.
I want to come back to Dr. Yazanov and this kind of Boston stamp or the stamp of geneticism on our time. You make a wonderful connection in your book with Paul Gauguin and the very famous, great, huge painting in the Museum of Fine Arts, the Who Are We, Where Are We Going, almost a mural, one of his great pieces, thoughtful South Sea setting. But as you say, biology has become sort of the place where we are to look now for the answer of who are we? You are your DNA, this kind of thing. Connectome tells you who you are. And it always gets my back up to think that that's who I am, because it's not. But how did this conviction, used to be physics in the early 20th century that was going to change our world. There was that matter of the bombs in the mid-century. And since then, there's been this migration out of physics into biology and a kind of almost, I think of it as sort of the Old Testament and the New. We have a new religion, and it's biology, definitely in this town, in our banks, in the Kendall Square, hordes of talented young people that get off in those buildings every morning. How did this happen, and should we be a little guarded about believing it?
Well, we should always be guarded about believing hype. I think part of the reason that the so-called it happened was that this coincided with our discovering the finiteness of the earth and a sort of sense that the living things that are growing on the earth have to depend increasingly on ourselves and the material that we produce. So it began with agriculture to some extent, that we're not going to be able to feed the masses, and then questions about where those masses should go and what kinds of lives they should lead. And, you know, we are to some extent seduced by the great gains of science and technology in the 20th century, which are often restated in terms of increasing lifespans, decreasing likelihood of illness. We don't stop to think about the fact that lifespans have actually been dropping in some segments of American society in the last several years. So this fixation on particular forms of disease and illness and particular forms of correctives make us turn a blind eye to the social customs through which, for instance, suicide rates have been increasing and the opioid crisis has been taking more lives than we think. So, you know, there's a sort of myth of progress told across the 20th century, coupled with a sense that resources are now inside of organisms. And then, of course, there are brilliant discoveries and brilliant breakthroughs, no question, which drive forward a particular mythology of progress. But I think that, you know, secularization to some extent has to still take account of the fact that there's a spiritual domain. And this is why I turn to the Gauguin painting, because those three questions that he puts, where do we come from, who are we, where are we going, he got them from his Catholic faith. But I think regardless how secularly you are raised, you have some answers to those, and I don't think those lie in the test tube.
When we come back, Jantine, I want to raise another, for me is an ethical question, how great minds, great scientists, stay human, stay humble in the midst of all this money, all this rush of progress, this and the intense fashionable quality of aggressive science in our community in this time. But that's another matter. Coming up, it may be a universal longing to improve our human stock, but it has a cautionary, very specifically modern history and a name. The name is eugenics. Dan Kevelis, coming up, wrote the great book on it. This is Open Source. Of course, the old-fashioned way to improve the species has always been to marry up and mate with someone stronger, smarter, and better-looking than you are, and stir the gene pool all you can. The organized modern version of that drive gets complicated, though. And the historian Daniel Kevelis, now at Yale, wrote the story of it to great acclaim. In the name of eugenics, genetics and the uses of human heredity. Dan, welcome. We talk about Hitler babies and the Nazi fantasies of a master race, but remind us, the science of eugenics was an English and American movement, too.
Yes, it was actually a movement that arose just about almost everywhere there was any kind of advanced scientific society in the world in the early 20th century. Eugenics happened everywhere. It's a mistake, really, to blame it all on the Nazis, because the Nazis learned from us, the Americans.
In fact, it was born here? You're saying, in fact, it was born here.
No, it wasn't only, it wasn't born here. I'm saying that the...
But they got the idea from us?
What they learned from us was our eugenic sterilization laws and the popularity of eugenics. Hitler read, attributed some of his ideas on what became the Nazi program of eugenics, mass sterilization, and ultimately the death camps to the American program. But it wasn't only us who invented it. Francis Galton, for example, a cousin of Charles Darwin's, is the man who, in the late 19th century, coined the term eugenics to mean good in birth, noble in heredity, with the idea of improving the quality of the human race.
You remind me that Scott Fitzgerald in The Great Gatsby, he was halfway into it, and Tom Buchanan in that book has read a book by Galton, he changes the name, and he's worried that if we don't look out, the white race will be utterly submerged, he says. It's all scientific stuff. It's been proved.
Yes, that's right. I remember that passage. Eugenics was a very, very popular movement, a notion, a set of ideas, stereotypes, and so on. In this country, it was largely absorbed with preventing the degeneration of the American race, quote-unquote, by discriminating against immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe, who were taken to be genetically or hereditarily inferior to native white Protestants. And eugenicists played a role in the, not a decisive role, but a role in the passage of the Immigration Restriction Act of 1924, which is, has, of course, contemporary resonances in the United States today. So the point of eugenics, though, I mean, not the point, but the principal aim of eugenics, and certainly in terms of public policy, was not human improvement, because they didn't know how to do it, except to encourage the so-called good people to reproduce more. The principal aim was to really to prevent the so-called inferior people from reproducing, and they did this by preventing more of them from entering the country with immigration restriction, by passing eugenic sterilization laws in a bunch of states, and also by seeking the sanction of these eugenic sterilization laws in the legal system, especially through the Supreme Court, which ruled in 1927 in a notorious case of Buck v. Bell that eugenic sterilization laws were okay. And that the opinion, by the way, was written by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes.
I was just going to say, was that the case in which he said three generations of imbeciles is enough?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Dan Kiblish, you have said that that history casts a shadow forward. In the age, as the age of CRISPR was dawning, 3 years ago, you wrote about eugenics. Politically, it's an untouchable third rail in American politics, overt racism, anti-Semitism, the rest. But scientifically, you said it is now far more plausible than it ever was, with new ways to modify humans by snipping a gene, not breeding or extermination. Eugenics, you said,
I think that the development of modern molecular biology and biotechnology has enabled the eugenics, if we wanted to pursue it, in a way that the early knowledge of genetics in the early 20th century did not enable. And I think that the concern here is not so much about eliminating inferior people, but it's about engineering people to be, maybe even at the embryonic stage, to be resistant to the hereditary diseases, or indeed to even enhance their human capacities by making it possible for them to put a basketball through a hoop at 30 feet or play consummately well at the violin, et cetera, et cetera. These kind of behavioral, artistic, and athletic triumphs no one knows really anything about the genes to that may contribute to those characteristics. But people do know a great deal. They're learning more and more about the genetics of disease. And I think that, you know, Sheila Jasanoff, my friend and admired colleague, is absolutely right that there are impulses to attribute social characteristics of social behavior that are widely regarded as adverse, such as criminality and so on, to genetics. And these are really have a long history of misgotten enterprises and conclusions. And we need to guard against that.
Jean-Tien,
when it comes to protecting people in future generations from, starting with the next generation, from really terrible diseases, then that's another story. That is a medical issue. And there, in many, many cases, hundreds and hundreds of single gene disorders, those are not social issues. I mean, in the sense that the environment is decisive in framing how people develop. Those are simply biochemical issues. And what we want to be able to do is, I think what scientists want to do is find out whether it's possible to edit these genes in order to get rid of these diseases in the germline. Now, there are profound ethical problems in doing that. To come back to the case in point of Mr. Hay, I think that he was reckless, irresponsible. He did consult ethicists, according to the news reports, and he just was confounded by the apprehensions that they raised, and they told him not to do it, and obviously he didn't pay attention to them. And he did, but he seems to me what he did was medically unnecessary. as many scientists have said. But also, he is focused only on one feature of the CCR5 gene, which is that it's an entryway into cells for the HIV. But the CCR5 gene plays multiple other roles in the immune system.
Right.
And as Jantine Lundsaf, if I pronounce that correctly, I apologize.
That's good. You're doing well.
Says that these little girls may well be super susceptible to infection.
Vulnerable.
Dan,
forgive me. I want to ask
attention to that.
I want to ask Jantine.
So, there are genuine issues of safety, and that seems to me to be the principal barrier right now to using CRISPR to fix some kind of disorder or disease that is essentially and entirely genetic.
Okay, hold it there, Dan. I want to ask Jantine in the church lab, what is the test that you apply for the taint of eugenic thinking in the work being done on projects day to day?
In the church lab, there are no projects done that have a direct bearing on eugenics. It's a fundamental science lab. So that's really still very remote from eugenic applications. In the case of he, it is actually very interesting indeed that it is not, he was not curing or guaranteeing, trying to achieve a disease-free child. But what he actually did was an intervention that can be seen in the perspective of public health interventions. And when you think of public health interventions, then of course you get to changing the human gene pool for the benefit of public health. You get very close to the purposes of eugenics.
I wanted
maybe I don't think, I mean, what eugenics. Let's be clear. Eugenics was a dream that turned into a nightmare. Eugenics is also depended enormously and almost universally on state intervention.
Exactly.
It's hard for me to imagine the state mandating in any of the Western democracies. I don't know about the rest of the world, but in any of the Western democracies, mandating that everybody has to undergo some kind of gene modification in order to have a child. I just don't see that's in the cards in the foreseeable future and long past that.
At another level, some of the quick reactions to the China news are almost funny. Here's the biocapitalist take from an opinion columnist on Bloomberg News this week. He wrote that, you know, totalitarian China might have ruined the species if they'd stuck with it, but American freedom, applying good CRISPR, might save the human race. He says, my guess is that editing out of our genetic tendency toward anxiety and depression will be a much more feasible productivity booster. Also, antidepressant, anti-anxiety, antipsychotic drug use is already widespread, so it seems reasonably possible that genetics will eventually be accepted as a further treatment of those problems. If so, national output and well-being will both improve.
Kinds of speculations.
Should we talk about biocapitalism?
Well, no. I'll say on that point that I think that if this technology becomes safe and reliable, whatever that means, and people then can use it in order to ensure that they conceive and give birth to healthy children, not enhanced children, just healthy children, that there will be an enormous consumer demand for it, just the way you see consumer demand generated by advertisements on for medical pharmaceuticals on television every night.
You've thought that consumer demand, this is for Dan, and commercial interest in these products is going to decide the future. I mean, is that ethical? Is that wise? Is that human in the long term?
Pardon?
Well, we're letting consumer demand is one thing, but the commercial value of this whole project.
Eventually there will be high commercial value if it can be made safe and effective. Just the way you know, there's a great deal of apprehension and debate and over the advent of recombinant DNA in the 1970s. People found ways to make it reasonably safe, et cetera, I suppose. That kind of debate has and apprehension has largely subsided.
Sheila Jasanoff, I'm wondering, here's a philosophical question for you. In all the cheering for an improved humanity, don't we hear a sort of ruthless farewell to the good old flawed humanity, which we all know we are? Bye-bye Kierkegaard, bye-bye Dostoevsky, bye-bye human tragedy, the tragic imagination, Shakespeare, Sophocles, even Jesus. I mean, he came to redeem us, and now we're improved.
All the mid-century totalitarian visions for how science was going to render us equal and take tragedy away, they all have in them tragic characters who refuse to be standardized. I have to say that I have deep problems with the kind of economic inevitability imagination that some people are putting forward. So take the genetic improvements, the quotation you give from the Bloomberg News. I mean, it strikes me as beyond flawed. It's a tragic imagination in a certain way, if you would think ironically about tragedy.
What about anxiety and depression?
Well, what's the idea that we create workplaces in which we put ever more increasing demands on people so that they're unable to cope and then they suffer from anxiety and then we gene edit them so that they're no longer anxious? I mean, you know, put against it other kinds of policies that other societies are following, like reduce the number of working days, grant longer parental leaves. I don't know where the scientific foundation comes from to say that an ever more increased productivity on the industrial model of Fordism and Taylorism run wild with depression controlling genetic enhancements down the line, or maybe we call them treatments at that stage, that's a better society than a society in which, on far stronger scientific foundations, we know that if mothers and fathers and children are allowed to bond for longer, if longer parental leaves are given, if more resources are provided for childcare, that we get healthier societies in that way. So why should the brilliant biological minds that have tools at their disposal be allowed to override already established eons of experience on how to raise healthy children in healthy families, in healthy societies? I'm afraid that we're, in essence, creating the nightmare scenario in order to provide the nightmare cure.
And then it comes to fairly obvious questions. You walk through Cambridge and you see those Koch family laboratories, some of them engaged in precisely these genetic sciences. And what if somebody said to the Koch brothers, why don't you clean up your environment? Stop sending coal fumes into our air, and maybe that would be an even more valuable contribution. Is that a fair ethical question, Shantine?
Well, it's a common sense question. And I think to the happiness and the reduction of depression or anxiety through genetic means, I completely agree with Dr. Jasanov on that. We know the strategies already now that could improve the situation, and that would be ad hoc, because we should not forget that we're talking not in a logical timeline, because any germline modification made now will only lead to, say, a happier employee in 20 years.
I want to ask each of you one quick question, simple answer. It comes from the great biologist Matthew Messelson. He said, the question is, are we rooting for the success of Dr. Hu's experiment or its failure? What are you rooting
for? Failure.
Failure, Jantine.
Failure.
Sheila. Dan Kevelis.
Well, I don't know what you mean by success or failure. I have in mind the two little girls. And in that regard, I hope for his success that they don't suffer.
I hope for their success. We'll see about him. Thank you, Dan Kevelis. Thank you, Sheila Jasanoff and Jantine Lunshoff. Thanks also to Yarden Katz. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Rebecca Panofka, the artist Susan Coyne, George Hicks, and Matt Lissette, who engineered the show. Mary McGrath is our hybrid bio-techno singularity. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.